The battles at Gaza are all part of a campaign towards recovering or capturing what was the Ottoman part of the empire. Jerusalem was part of the Ottoman world, the Turkish Empire at that time, and the British army were advancing, and eventually they did secure Jerusalem. So this isn't the first time Jerusalem has been in the news. Jerusalem is very much in the news at the moment. I'm sure there's not anybody here who's kind of missed that. There's a great deal of activity over there from time to time, and in the First World War, in the present times, and in former times as well. We've been hearing about the British and the Turks. Now there are other kinds of conflicts there. It's always a trouble spot in different ways and at different times, because it's a region that is affected by powerful competitions between politics and power and religion. And Jerusalem itself is at the very heart of all of these things, isn't it? It's the hub for all these different kind of deeply divided communities all see Jerusalem as being their city. And it's the kind of source of a lot of this conflict is who has the rights to this city, the city Jerusalem. And these communities that we're referring to sometimes just find themselves in sort of a simmering hostility towards one another. Other times, not enjoying that relative peace, but are finding themselves in open conflict, in times of war as well. So when you get these situations, two people groups occupying one region with two centers of power, and then both contesting for Jerusalem, it is a recipe, isn't it, for these kind of tensions. And add into the mix on the borders of the country other nations with other peoples, sometimes aggressive nations. No surprise is that by turns, war and peace come and go across this region of the world. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Isn't it ironic that Jerusalem, the name, means the city of peace? The city of peace seems to be the subject of so much human warring, so much conflict over the very place, the very thing that seems to have been placed there that people should be at peace with one another. And I think that's the thing I really want to pick up with you this morning to start with, as we're going to be looking in this book of Micah, that the city of peace is at the center of this ongoing war, this ongoing conflict. It's this ironic thing. Now, these kind of descriptions that I've just made about two people competing for one city and so on sound like a description of the modern situation. Maybe you thought I was referring particularly to the modern situation, and I am, obviously, but I'm actually referring to the background, the historical context of the writing of this book, which we heard a reading from at the beginning of the service, this book of Micah. So I don't know if you've got the book open in front of you, but this book was written nearly 2,800 years ago, about 700 more years before Jesus was even born. And the situation concerning Jerusalem was exactly that. Two competing peoples, both testing the city of Jerusalem, this simmering hostilities, this sometimes passable peaces, followed by open conflict and open war. At that time, when Micah, because Micah was a citizen of the city of Jerusalem, he lived there nearly 2,800 years ago. When he lived there, to the north, in the area that I suppose we would call the West Bank or something like that today, was called the Kingdom of Israel. And the 10 Israel in the north, and they had a separate kingdom there. And in Jerusalem and to the southern region, which is part of the modern state of Israel today, was a kingdom called the Kingdom of Judah. And Jerusalem was its official capital. The north was the capital was Samaria. In the south, the kingdom of Judah had its official capital at Jerusalem. But the northern kingdom contested Jerusalem for itself. Both kingdoms believed that Jerusalem was its rightful capital. Both these parties, and they were both locked in this long-standing, bloody civil war, and the claim was that Jerusalem was their own. And this was the situation that Micah was living in. This was the times that Micah was living in. These people who had so much in common, they shared so much, and yet seemingly they were unable to properly share this city, this place, and to live at peace with each other. They both claimed the city to be their own because it was their spiritual heart, their spiritual center, the place which they believed God had appointed where they should worship him. And in the center of the city at that time stood this magnificent temple, this beautiful temple. It had been the dream of the great King David that there should be one place where all God's people should meet for worship. And he put a huge amount of his own personal fortune into making sure that there was sufficient funds to build this glorious building in the heart of the city. And then his son Solomon built it. And to all reports, it was a magnificent place. And there was a short season, a short period of time, where all the people of the region, with one heart and one voice, all joined together and would go to Jerusalem and go and worship together at Jerusalem, go and worship in the temple. And centuries afterwards, when Micah comes along, they look back at that time as a kind of golden age, a time of spiritual flowering. Many of the Psalms were written at that time. Many of the things that we benefit from were all from that period, from that season, a time of great prosperity, a time of great peace, a great unity, a great time of spiritual blessing, peace with their neighbors as well. And people look back at that as a sort of glorious golden age when they enjoyed what they called the United Kingdom, when all the tribes were one people, one group, one God, one city, one temple. And that was the time that it seemed to slip through their fingers. And they were now in this period that had descended into division and conflict and disagreement and hostilities and tensions. And so the city of peace at the time of Micah had become the center of this war. And it was really a fight about the worship of God. People were fighting about worshiping God. Now, Jesus gave us an expression which has become very, very popular today. He said, a house divided, can you complete it? A house divided cannot stand. We all know it so well, don't we? A house divided cannot stand. Jesus said that. And Micah, the writer who we're looking at this morning, was somebody who understood that principle very, very well. He knew full well at that time that the writing was on the wall. If you cannot share, if you can't live at peace with each other, if you're consumed with hostility towards one another, if all your energies are going into fighting each other and infighting and fighting amongst oneself, he can see what was going to happen. In chapter 3, verse 12, he sees what's going to happen. He looks ahead down the line. He's part of the kingdom of Judah himself. He's been in this long-running conflict with the kingdom of Israel in the north. And chapter 3 and verse 12, he sees what God is going to do. And he says, therefore, because of you, and now he's speaking to the people of Israel and the people of Judah, because of this long-running conflict and dispute over the city of peace, therefore, because of you, Zion, and that is the part of the city where the temple was built, Zion shall be plowed like a field. So this glorious building, which was standing there at that time, which everybody was squabbling about and arguing about, he looks ahead and he says, because of all these fighting, because of all these arguments, I don't know if any of you have had children who've disagreed over a present, they fought over a present. And how many parents have came to the same conclusion? Well, if you can't share it, neither of you are going to have it. And therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed like a field. He's going to do away with the temple completely. Jerusalem, if you keep reading, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the house of the Lord, of the house, that's the house of the Lord, the temple, are wooded heights. He's going to just hand the whole thing. He's going to turn the whole place back to nature, back to a wilderness. If you can't use it properly, you'll lose it completely. And that's the kind of the warnings that Micah was echoing out to his people and to the communities that were coming around at his time. This is such a long time ago. You keep fighting. You keep squabbling over the things of God. You keep arguing. Do you know what? You're going to lose the whole thing. You'll lose your place with God completely. That's the warning that he was giving. So he foresees, doesn't he, the destruction of God's temple. He foresees the destruction of the city of peace. You'll have no city of peace. You'll have no refuge to go to. You'll have no sanctuary to which you can turn. There'll be no way where you'll be able to find God. And that's the kind of warnings that the prophet Micah was giving to his people. And both the kingdoms, Israel and Judah, he foresaw that both these kingdoms, not only would he destroy the city and destroy the temple, he would make sure that both of these kingdoms were utterly destroyed too. He was going to put an end to their existence. As far as Micah was concerned, God had decreed that they were both as bad as each other. You look in chapter 1 and verse 6 and 7 with me for a moment. Chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, we get an insight into what it was like in the kingdom of Israel in the north with its capital Samaria that contested that Jerusalem should be theirs as a place for worship. He says, of Samaria, I'll make Samaria a heap. In other words, the capital city is also going to be destroyed. A place for planting vineyards. I'd rather put some grapes there than have people like you living there. I'll pour down her stones into the valley and uncover her foundations. And then in verse 7, you really see what's at the heart of the people there. All her carved images. Now, this isn't just an ornamentation around people's dwellings. All the carved images shall be beaten to pieces. All her wages shall be burned with fire. And her idols will be laid to waste. You see, these images wasn't just pretty buildings and nice things on the buildings. These were things that, these beautiful things, people were worshipping things. From the fee of a prostitute, she gathered them, and for the fee of a prostitute, they were exploiting people, weren't they? They were exploiting people to generate wealth, and they were worshipping the things, the physical things that they produced. They made things. They were, if I can put it like this, they were so materialistic. They would do anything to make sure that they had the material things that they set such store on. They valued those things even above God. They were more important to them. The things were more important than the one who made all things. And their desire to have Jerusalem was really that acquisitive desire just to possess something, to say it's mine. That kind of materialism. Not spiritual. Not a kind of a right spirit at all. That's what was going on. They loved things more than they loved God. That's pretty clear, isn't it? And when you get into the kingdom of Judah as well, verse 13, just go down a little bit further in chapter 1. Here, the prophecy continues, and Micah is telling the people of a place called Lachish. I've been to that place. It's just south of Jerusalem. There are all sorts of vineyards planted there. But at that time, there was a small town there, a city, a walled city there. And they had a military detachment there. Harness the steeds of the chariot, inhabitants of Lachish. It was the beginning of sin to the daughters of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. So the daughters of Zion, that expression refers to all, Zion was the city of Jerusalem, and then around it were all these towns and villages. They're called the daughters of Zion. And that's the kingdom of Judah. And when you look inside the kingdom of Judah, they've got military power, they've got their chariots and their horses, but really look in their hearts. The things that the people of Israel are into, they're into them just as much. That rampant materialism, that idolatrous kind of materialism, is as present in the daughters of Jerusalem as it is in the kingdom of Israel. So don't go pointing fingers and saying, we're better than you lot, or you're better than us. They're all the same. Can you see that? Micah can see that his own people were just as bad as those people they were fighting against. And it was making its way, this attitude was making its way even into the city itself. If you look in chapter 3, here's God's city, the city of peace. Chapter 3 and verse 10. And Zion, people brought their offerings and brought their gifts into the city. But look where they came from. You who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. That this city, which was supposed to be a place of righteousness and peace and justice, a spiritual place, a place where you could meet with God and hear God and worship God. What's actually happening is that it's been turned into this filthy and materialistic place. You know, in chapter 4, just look with me a moment. Chapter 4, turn over the page. Chapter 4, this is what Jerusalem was supposed to be. Chapter 2, verse 4, verse 2. And many nations shall come. This was the dream. This was the vision for the city. Many nations shall come, people from all around the world, and say, come, let's go up to the mountains of the Lord. Let's go to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways. And that we might walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. That's the dream, isn't it? The people come from all around the world. And they would be spiritually enriched and blessed and helped to live in a way that pleases God all around the world. And that was a place where they should be able to come. And in the time of Micah, he can see that they are. That's not how it is. That's not how their life is at that time. It was idolatrous. They loved things much more than they loved God. So the conclusion is that neither party deserved Jerusalem. The city had been ruined by, not physically, I'm sure it looked great. You walk down the road, I'm sure the streets looked tidy and clean and all those sort of things. But at the heart of it, what it was all about, it had become dirty and dirtied by their attitudes. And so the conclusion comes that neither of these people would be able to enjoy the city. He was going to have the whole place knocked down, flattened, destroyed, so that neither would be able to enjoy it or defile it anymore. See, I think what comes over here is that God has determined that he won't be worshipped by the ungodly. He won't be worshipped by the ungodly. These warring parties. First, you've got to lay down your unforgiveness. You've got to lay down your hostility. You've got to come to God in the right way, in the right spirit. Otherwise, he won't be worshipped by you at all. And Micah seems to understand, doesn't he, these sort of things. What's the solution? What would be the solution? He can see very clearly what the resolution to this problem is. What these two parties needed to do was unite. They needed to make peace with each other. They needed to make peace with each other and make peace with God. But if that was going to happen, here's the single condition that God starts to lay upon them, and we'll see it very clearly from the scriptures in a moment. If they're going to unite, you can see what they're going to argue about. Well, who's going to be in charge? If we're going to share it, who's going to be ruling us? And can we have two kings, or my king or your king? Who's going to be in charge? And he sees that they've got to unite, but there can only be one king. There can only be one king over one united kingdom and one God and one place of worship that is shared by all the different people. And he sees that God has got a peace plan for Jerusalem. Chapter 4 and verse 12. Chapter 4 and verse 12. God's peace plan for Jerusalem. And Micah can see that nobody really understands what God is doing. That they carry on in this materialist. When you get materialistic, your eyes begin to close. You cannot see the spiritual realities that you're dealing with. You become blinded by these things. And in verse 12, chapter 4, verse 12, they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They're not listening to God. They don't understand what God is doing or what he's saying. They do not understand his plan, Micah tells us, that he has gathered them as sheaves to the threshing floor. He's got this plan. He's going to bring them all together and he's going to give them an absolute thrashing, isn't he? That's what the threshing floor is for. That's where you thrash the wheat. He's going to bring these people together and he's going to thrash them for the way that they have behaved and defiled his city, his temple. They can't see that, but Micah can see it because Micah's been given the gift of the Holy Spirit to see these things. But there are three things in the plan that God is bringing about. The first is he's going to grant the Assyrians and the Babylonians victory. Now, let me just explain for those of you, their ancient history is maybe not as sharp as it used to be when they were at school, but just to say that in the north there, where we see Syria now, and parts of Lebanon going into Iran and southern Turkey and northern Iraq, that was the Assyrian Empire at that time. And where we now see in Iraq, southern Iraq there, into Jordan, bits of Saudi Arabia, into Iran and the south, that was the Babylonian Empire. And they were right on the borders of Judah and Assyria. And God determines that he's going to allow these great nations to come and conquer the land, flatten the place. He's going to hand them over to them. And we see that in chapter 1 and verse 16. What's going to happen to the people of Israel? Chapter 1 and verse 16. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair for the children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle. Did you know that expression comes from there? Bald as an eagle is a biblical term. For they shall go from you into exile. So the Assyrians are going to come and take your people back to Assyria. And they're going to lay your land to waste. And in chapter 4 and verse 10, he speaks to the people of Judah. Writhe and groan, O daughters of Zion. That's all these Judean towns and villages. Like a woman in labor. For now you shall go out from the city and dwell in the open. You shall go to Babylon. So he determines these two nations to come to conquer their peoples and take the peoples away back to their homelands. That's the first part of the thrashing. The second part of the plan, in chapter 4 and verse 6, after they have, this just happens when you've been corrected. Do you, anybody here ever send their kids to their room sometimes or something like that? You know, just to cool off and think about it maybe a little bit. So here, you can see that he's going, in chapter 4 and verse 6, when they've had a bit of time to cool off and think about it, chapter 4 and verse 6, in that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather those who've been driven away and those who've been afflicted. And the lame I will make the remnant and those who are cast off a strong nation. And the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from this time and forever. He's going to bring them back. He's going to restore them, isn't he? He's going to bring them back to the land and he's going to unite them. When they're ready to be at peace with each other, then you can come back. That's the second part of the plan. Once they're ready to submit to God's rule, they've been humbled, and they're ready to stop bickering and fighting amongst themselves. But what about this king? What about this king? That's the third and most important part of the plan. Chapter 5. Chapter 5, which we read earlier, from verse 2 through to 5. There's going to be a king to rule over them. And God will appoint the king, and we're told exactly where the king will be born. You, O Bethlehem Ephrata, who are too little to be amongst the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who's to be ruler in Israel. The whole kingdom should be ruled by this one king born in Bethlehem. And of course, that's the city where David had been born, King David. And he's prophesying, isn't it, a kind of revival when the old ways will not be a thing of the past, but a better time will come in the future where everybody will be united under this one king who God sends. Three parts of the plan. If you can't share Jerusalem, nobody will have it. When you're ready to share Jerusalem, I will give you another start, another chance to come back and to rebuild the place. And thirdly, I will not allow you to go back to being divided. I will put a king over you. And what's clear as you look in chapter 5, verses 10 through to 15, is that this king is going to stamp out idolatry. He's going to cleanse them. He's going to make sure that these things don't resurface amongst them. He's going to deal with their enemies. He won't let the Assyrians or the Babylonians have power over them ever again. If you look through those verses, and he will establish true worship. It will be established under his rule because he truly loves God. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. And it shall come to pass in those later days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established at the highest of the mountains. It shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it when the king is ruling from his throne. So true worship will come when the king comes. And until then, there will be no lasting peace. The wars won't end until the king is ruling over his people in Jerusalem. And we see that in chapter 4, verse 3. He shall judge between many nations. He shall decide between strong nations. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. When the king comes. Chapter 5, verse 3. Therefore he shall give them up until that time when she who is in labor has given birth. And then the rest of the brothers shall return to the people of Israel. A time of great peace when the king finally comes. So this has happened 700 years, like I say, 2,800 years ago, 700 odd years before Christ. And Micah is confronted with what he's going to do between as he waits for this plan to be worked out. And he realizes in chapter 6, all he can do is wait. All he can do is wait. And there's nothing that anybody can do to change God's mind about his plan. Chapter 6 and verse 7 says, will the Lord be pleased with 1,000 rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgressions, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Nothing anybody can do can change God's mind. He's going to take the city away. He's going to send them into exile, and only when they're submitted to the king that he gives them will there be peace. You can't buy off God. And that's the materialism, isn't it, again? You think you can buy anything. You can buy anyone. You can't buy God. You can't change his mind. He's Lord. He doesn't need our money. Until then, he just has to wait. Chapter 6, verse 8 onwards. He has told you, O man, what is good. This is so important to hear, isn't it? What does the Lord require of you? Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. That's the plan, isn't it? That's what we have to do. And he's telling the people very clearly. And Micah understands that. So God is calling his people to unite under his king. But until such time, their worship will not be accepted. Okay? Well, just this is the final section, really. Assyria, in 722 BC, did indeed invade and conquer the kingdom of Israel. And their army swept right up into towards Jerusalem in 701 BC. All the daughters of Jerusalem were also flattened and destroyed by the Assyrian armies. But only Jerusalem survived this invasion. Micah saw it all happen with his own eyes. And then the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians, and all the people who'd been taken into exile in Assyria that were now under the control of the Babylonians. And the Babylonians invaded, and the Babylonians in 586 BC, just as Micah said, conquered the city of Jerusalem and flattened it and leveled it to the ground and took the people away into Babylonia. 70 years later, though, just as God has promised, as was referred to in chapter 7, verse 20 of Micah, chapter 7, verse 20 of Micah, you shall show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham as you swore to our fathers in the days of old. After 70 years, the people started to come back to the city. They started to come back to the city, and as one people, they began to rebuild the city. And as one people, they started to rebuild the temple. Well, what about the king? The king who will ultimately be the only one to bring Jerusalem's lasting peace. Now we need to go to the New Testament for our final bit. Chapter 1 of the Gospel of Matthew. Chapter 1 of the Gospel of Matthew. right at the beginning. So the king, for centuries it seems, does not appear. And there are conquests and reconquests of the city. And though they build the temple, there's strife and trouble there all through those times. And people continue to bicker and fight amongst themselves. But then we see in chapter 1, verse 1, this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. Can you see that that reference, son of David, is a reference back to the person who will be born in Bethlehem, the city of David, where the kings are going to be born. Right at the beginning of the gospel, we're told that this child is the son of David. And as we read on in verse 17, you look at the way that he talks about the different generations, all his whole genealogy is laid out, his forefathers going back for centuries, Jesus' forebears going back generations. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation of Babylon to Christ, 14 generations. He refers to this exile. He connects Jesus' coming right back to the events of the exile that happened hundreds of years before. And then in chapter 1, verse 21, we read concerning now Mary, she will bear a son. She will bear a son, which is clearly a reference to what we read in Micah about the woman bringing forth a child. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, because he will save his people, all his people, from their sins. And so at the beginning of the gospel, we start to hear this announcement, and it's confirmed when we read in chapter 2 and verse 1, after this, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Ephratah, that this prophecy about this king, that this Jesus is this king, whom God has promised to unite his people and all peoples under his rule. And until you submit to him, your worship will not be accepted. Jesus is that king, isn't he? And you can see in chapter 2 and verse 4, the assembly of the chief priests and the scribes, Herod is asking who was king at that time. He inquired of them, where is this Christ to be born? And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. Why? Because they knew about Micah. They knew about the prophecies. They were expecting this coming king. And they said to him, for it is written by the prophet, you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, by no means least amongst the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. It's Jesus, isn't it? Jesus is the long-expected king. You see that there in verse 5 and verse 6, Jesus is the king. And until people submit to Jesus, until everybody submits to Jesus, quite clearly, there will be no peace. There will be no lasting peace. And Herod makes out, doesn't he? Chapter 2, verse 8, this really comes to the quick here. Herod makes out that he's interested in these things, that he cares about these things. He's sent to Bethlehem saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. He makes a show, doesn't he, of being interested in Jesus as king, Jesus as Lord. But you know Herod, don't you, from all the little nativity stories that you've seen and heard, you know what he was like. He had no interest in those things. He was only concerned, as we see in chapter 2 and verse 16, when he sends his troops down there to try and annihilate all the children of Bethlehem. The only king he's interested in is being king himself. And that's that same materialism, isn't it? I don't care who gets hurt. I don't care what it costs. I don't care who has to suffer for my comfort. I'm king around here. And not even God will be a rival to me to do what I want to do when I want to do it and the way I want to do it. And you know well enough that as Jesus rose, the opposition rose with to him. They surrounded him and hunted him down and hounded him, and they crucified Jesus. And over his cross was the words, King of the Jews. King. There's no wonder, is it, that Jerusalem was destroyed again after that time. It's no wonder, is it, that the temple was destroyed again. If you don't learn the lesson the first time, anybody had to ever resit an exam? You just have to do it again. This time, not 70 years of exile, 2,000 years of exile. And where's the peace that Micah spoke about? After all this time, where is the peace in Jerusalem to this very day? And the modern situation is different to the times of Micah. Of course it is. It's complicated and different. But there's a spiritual truth here. Until people submit to the king that God has appointed, there can be no lasting peace. But does that mean the prophecy is empty and there's no power to it at all? Do you find peace on earth? Is there peace on earth? Well, you find peace on earth in the places and amongst the people who've submitted themselves to God's king. You do find that. In fact, you find out that God's king is building a new city, a new Jerusalem. And he's building a new temple, more glorious than the temples that ever stood at that time and in that place. He's building that through the interconnected lives of people who've put their trust in him. We're told in Peter that the body of Christ, the people of God, are his temple. We're being built up into a temple. We are the Jerusalem coming down from above. God's people. There are some very different people in the kingdom of God, aren't there? Very different people who, without Christ, we'd perhaps be at conflict and war with each other. But through him, we've learned to forgive one another. Through him, we've become reconciled to one another. Through him, we've become a people who weren't a people, who've become a people under the rule and reign of God's appointed king, Jesus Christ. God is that appointed king, isn't he? So finally, just some practical things to reflect on before we go outside in a moment. Some lessons for us. Micah chapter 6, verse 8 still holds good. Walk humbly with your God. Do what's right. Walk humbly with your God. Those things still hold good for us today, don't they? As we wait for the kingdom to continue to enlarge and expand, and we pray in the fullness of time that Jerusalem and the whole earth would be filled with the peace of the Lord. He has told you, O man, what's good and what the Lord requires of you. Do justly, love kindness, to walk humbly with your God. And that means submitting to God's appointed king, to Jesus. Look, Christmas is coming. We've complained. How many of us have complained for how long about the materialism? It's not of the Lord, is it? It's not of the Lord. It's about Christ. It's about walking in his ways. That's what Christmas is about, if it is about anything at all. And continuing to strive. Sometimes families come together over Christmas time and there's long-standing feuds and arguments and Auntie Mabel's not talking to so-and-so and so forth. You know, that's not the spirit of the Lord, is it? It brings people who are at war into peace with each other, surrendering to one another and so that they might worship God in the right spirit. Self-centered living. That is not the spirit of Christmas. It's Christ-centered living, isn't it, that's at the heart of Christmas. Prideful self-determination, doing everything your way when you want to do it, rather than looking to the King and asking him for his guidance and direction for our lives. So this Christmas, we've got a fresh chance to make peace with God, haven't we? This opportunity is being offered to all of us all the time to make God. But sadly, how often the opportunity comes and we just throw it away. We just dismiss it out of hand. Another time, another place. Don't throw it away. Christ has come, born in Bethlehem. Submit to him and be part of this peace which belongs uniquely to his kingdom. This Christmas, in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 2 and verse 11, chapter 2 and verse 11, we see the right spirit at work, don't we? Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. They fell down and they worshipped him. They fell down and they worshipped him. Let's just leave that with you. Jesus, the King of Peace. Jesus, the King of Peace. Once in Royal David's City, number 10 in the Carol Service book. Once in Royal David's